So do you like grapefruit?
Well, I like fruit and I like grapes, but I mean, I'm not really a big fan of grapefruit, surprisingly. All right. Well, you're listening to Wheelin' with Keith and Johnny Orange. How are you doing today, John?
Not too bad. How about yourself, Keith?
I'm doing all right. So this is podcast number 3. We've gotten the first two, we introduced who we are, and we talked about the museum that we are so closely attached to. And so now it's time to start talking a little bit about four-wheel drive vehicles and a little bit of history and whatnot.
That's good. I thought this was the part of the anonymous meetings where we tell a story.
Well, yeah, there is going to be a story today. There is.
So I should go get some popcorn, is what you're saying, and settle in.
You know, I guess the easy, maybe a little popcorn would be good. Maybe the easiest way to kind of get into this is to talk about our first vehicle briefly. When we had our meeting where we did our founding articles and we were all talking about what we were going to do with the museum and what vehicles we wanted, do you remember the hit list of vehicles that we wanted to have?
That's been a long time ago, man.
All right. Well, I'd come along and with a list, and a few other people had some vehicles as well, but there was some vehicles that had very important moments in the history of four-wheel drive and the development of these off-road vehicles. And one of them that was pretty high up on the list was called NAPCO. Have you heard of NAPCO before?
A few times, yeah.
All right. NAPCO. N-A-P-C-O. NAPCO. Now, NAPCO was a producer of conversion kits to convert, back in the late 40s, early 50s, your Chevrolet, your GMC pickup truck to four-wheel drive. It was a kit that would be delivered to the dealership and put onto the vehicle at the dealership, and then it could be put right onto your payment and whatnot. You could also get Studebaker and Ford vehicles with NAPCO kits, but it was a little more uncommon. They do exist, though. So I had mentioned that we needed to get a NAPCO for the museum. And as fate would have it, the very next morning after our first meeting, sitting there having coffee in the morning, and I'm scrolling through Facebook, and on one of the marketplace posts, there's a NAPCO fire truck for sale. And as you know, we now own this NAPCO fire truck.
Indeed.
And that NAPCO fire truck, we found out was going to potentially be sold to someone who was going to cut it up, and we contacted the owner, and we ended up with it. And, you know, maybe in the future, we should do a whole episode maybe about that truck. And that's kind of, I think, what we were thinking about doing here originally. But doing some research on NAPCO and the history of NAPCO, really a human interest story kind of came about. The whole beginnings of NAPCO and where NAPCO came from. And so before we talk too much about our own truck, which is in the museum now, and is our first acquisition, as you know. Let's talk a little bit about how NAPCO came to be.
Sounds good.
All right. So there was a gentleman born in Romania in 1881. His name's Edward Rappaport.
I thought you were going to say Dr. Acula, but
Dr. Acula? Oh, okay, yeah. There you go. Yes, no. This is Edward Rappaport, and he was a Jewish man, born in 1881 in Romania. And when he was only 3 years old, his father dies. Okay?
Bummer.
Exactly. Bummer. 1881, you know, but 1884, something like that, when his father dies. Pretty rough time still back then. His mom gets remarried. Okay? And she marries a guy named Morris Schwartz. And, of course, young Edward is only 3 years old. And so you figure, you know, today, you know, somebody gets remarried, you know, they raise the kids. Mm. Well, apparently Moritz Schwartz was not a big fan of the kids and sent all but one of his siblings off to the orphanage, himself included. Yeah.
Hmm.
So his baby sister, Jenny, got to stay with mom. Hmm. Everybody else, yep, new marriage, new kids. So that's kind of a rough beginning, isn't
it? Yeah, just a little bit, yeah.
A little bit of a rough beginning. Not laughing at his misfortune or anything. Oh, it's just a rough beginning.
Very unfortunate.
Very unfortunate. So you'd think, you know, well, maybe it's only up here. So he, about the age of 18, after being raised in an orphanage, Edward decides that he's going to come to the U.S., you know, the land of opportunity. This is when everybody's coming over, Ellis Island, the steamships and all of that. And he's going to come over to the United States. So he books passage on a ship, probably wasn't going first class. This was no Titanic. This was, well, Gesundheit there, John.
Thank you. Excuse me.
So he books probably some steerage class on a ship. Well, the ship, you know, back then, 1881, ship passage from Europe to the United States would take, you know, 5 to 8 days typically. But this one took a little bit longer than normal. We don't know the exact number of days. Might be, you know, out there somewhere, but in our research, weren't able to find how many days, but it took longer than normal. And supplies started to run low on the ship. Okay. So young Edward, he's 18 years old. He's on this ship. They're running out of food. Mm. They actually were able to somehow meet up with another ship that gave them some supplies. But they still didn't have enough supplies to get all the way there. So, as you can imagine, people are getting hungry on the ship. And they're getting to be a little cranky. And some things start to happen. Well, a man on the ship who apparently wrought with hunger and whatnot decides that he's going to take and remove the food or steal the food from a mother and her young baby. So Edward says, well, this isn't cool. So he's a stand-up guy, you know? And so he goes over and gets into a fight with this guy, essentially, and tries to stop him from...
So what you're saying is he rocked the boat a little bit?
Rocked the boat a little bit. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. So unfortunately, he wasn't a real big guy, and he lost the fight with the guy, with the food thief.
I've been there. Not fun.
Not fun. this guy was a little bit of a psychopath. Not Edward, the guy he got in the fight with, and couldn't leave this young Jewish man alone, and did what we'd call a hate crime today, and carved a crucifix into Edward's chest.
Ouch.
Yeah, I can't imagine that felt very good.
Yeah, I would imagine not.
So he was eventually let off the ship in Canada at a hospital, at a Catholic hospital, and was able to recover. Hmm. So he recovered, and he eventually decided that he was going to try to make his way to New York, and he did that. And at this point, apparently his mother and her new husband, possibly, I'm not 100% sure on that, had emigrated already as well. Hmm. So he re-met up with his siblings and his mother, you know, with the family. But, of course, at the time, there was a lot of Jewish people were a hard time to find jobs sometimes and whatnot. So he needed to look for work, and there was a lot of discrimination and whatnot. So he decided that he was going to try to head to Detroit, Michigan, because in Detroit, he had heard that there was a lot of opportunities in the industries there. And of course, we weren't the auto capital of the
world yet.
No, this is the 18. This would have been late 1890s at this point. So it's just kind of getting started there.
Yeah.
So he comes to Detroit, and he meets another Jewish man who he gets talking to. And he heard that Edward had come across on this ship, and he said, hey, I heard a guy got a you know, a young Jewish man got a crucifix carved into his chest. And he said, well, I was that guy, you know, so he ends up.
It's been one interesting conversation.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how word must travel pretty fast back then. Huh?
I guess somehow.
I don't know. I don't know how that how he heard about it, but he immediately took him in and things started to look up, you know, for young Edward now at this point. So now he's got a place in Detroit here. And like most upstanding young men, he falls in love with the guy's daughter who's already engaged to someone else.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, we're talking the Victorian morals era and whatnot. And that didn't work out so well. So he ran off and eloped with her in Windsor, Ontario. So
that's one way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. So, like I said, the story has got some twists and turns to it. So, he ends up getting married to her, and they have a child. And he hears that after the big earthquake in San Francisco, which, if I remember right, was 1906. I'd have to think here. 1906.
I don't remember that time period.
You don't remember that time?
No. I was not born for quite a few years after that.
Oh, okay. So. All right. So they had a big earthquake in San Francisco in 1906, and it pretty much wiped out the whole city. Leveled buildings. They had to rebuild everything. So he went out there looking for work. He was a tinsmith. He had learned that in Romania and decided that he was going to go San Francisco. Did that for a couple of years. Worked in the construction trades out there. And then he eventually came back east again. And his now wife, her family had resettled in the Minneapolis, Minnesota area.
I got family from there.
Oh, do you?
I do.
So do I, but not the favorite side of the family. So, you know. But, you know, it... still, Minneapolis is a beautiful area.
Oh, absolutely.
You know. So he ends up going back there, and he goes to Minneapolis, and he's basically trying to figure out what to do. And this is where himself and I are kindred spirits. He starts peddling junk out of his backyard. And cars had now been out for a few years. So he starts getting cars that have been wrecked and whatnot and pulling them apart and scrapping them out and starts essentially what today we would call a junkyard. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so he started or salvage yard. So he starts a junkyard there. And within a couple of years, it's now called in the listings there, Northwestern Auto Parts Company. So that's where you get NAPCO from. Northwestern Auto Parts Company.
Oh, makes sense.
So that's where the NAPCO comes from. But still has nothing to do with four-wheel drive.
Yeah. Yet.
So for years, Northwestern Auto Parts made all sorts of different parts for different vehicles. And they brand new parts, used parts, things like that. And they continued to develop. And they were pretty prosperous through the 20s and the 30s. And they continued to build, even through the Great Depression, which is pretty impressive.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, pretty impressive. So, in fact, they didn't even have have a public loss for many years. They had a profit every year they reported. So that impressive. Was yeah. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, today there's not a lot of companies today that can do that.
No,
right? You know. So, so World War II, of course, comes rolling around and need for all-terrain vehicles and four-wheel drive vehicles starts to, you know, we had that need during World War I, but World War II, we had even more of a need for it. And so General Motors starts producing some four-wheel drive vehicles, mostly big two-ton trucks. Dodge starts producing the WC carry or WC and WX, there's a bunch of different numbers or letters like that, and we can do a whole podcast on that sometime. But Dodge starts building four-wheel drive trucks that eventually became the Power Wagon.
Yeah.
And they start building all these things. NAPCO, of course, becomes a military contractor at the time, supplying a lot of small parts that are needed to various military outfits. So, you know, they do this during the war, and they get, of course, through the war. War is about 5 years, 4 years, and the war is over. And they see a need in this four-wheel drive market that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
After the war, Willys, which of course had made the Jeep during the war, mm-hmm. was making the very small Willys Jeeps, and they were making the, they were also making, of course, like the Willys pickups and the Willys yeah. wagons. These were small utilitarian vehicles that worked great for the family, for the local farm and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And then Dodge was making the Power Wagon, which was based off of the World War II design that was much more heavy duty.
Yeah.
But NAPCO kind of saw a hole in the market for a, what would be your modern pickup truck, you know, something with a, you know, nicer interior,
mm-hmm.
You know, a little bit more round lights, things like that. Something that just had a little bit of design to it.
Yeah.
And so they started putting together basically this package.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to put together something that could be converted. And I think that's probably going to be a good point. We'll start talking about this conversion thing in a minute after the break. So
that works, because I need more popcorn. This is a good story.
You need more popcorn.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
This personal interest story. All right.
Absolutely.
Well, we're going to take a break then, John.
See you in a bit. All right.
Have you heard the good news? Now there's a local paper that people just can't seem to get enough of. It's the Thumbprint News. The Thumbprint News is free and full of interesting stories that focus on what's important in our lives. Stories that touch on this area's rich history, unique places, and the diverse cultures and people. You'll be in the know when you read the Thumbprint News. Go to thumbprintnews.com and read the paper online for free today.
All right, we're back from the break, John. You got your popcorn and everything else.
Yeah, extra butter.
Yeah, there you go. Okay.
And cheese.
you know, and I'm trying to keep this as interesting as possible. Of course, to some of our listeners, this type of history is kind of dry. To others, it's pretty interesting and fascinating. And of course, to a gearhead like myself, this can be pretty interesting stuff.
And not just you. Thank you.
All right.
I've
all
not
right.
heard so, this story before.
So you still want to hear about
yeah,
this?
Yeah, let's go.
More. Okay. So after the war, like I said, he just figured that we needed to have some sort of nicer vehicle. But, of course, building a whole vehicle from scratch didn't make a lot of sense.
Mm.
Ford, General Motors, GMC, of course, Chevrolet, Studebaker were all building pretty good quality pickup trucks that the general buyer could buy and enjoy, but they weren't four-wheel drive. So NAPCO came up with this plan to put together a conversion kit. And what was kind of genius about it is they used about 85% parts that were readily available.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so they used like the corporate, the early version of the corporate 14 bolt. They used the dropout center section to make their front axle. They used Dodge Power Wagon internals and things like that. And they used readily available transfer cases from Spicer and Rockwell. So they were able to use all these off-the-shelf parts and then make just a few things, like they made the front axle housing itself.
Hmm.
And the knuckles, but then the brakes were still factory GM brakes, and they could put this whole thing together and put it into a crate, and they would ship it to the dealership. So you would nice. Go, let's pretend it's like 1952-53, and you wanted a nicer four-wheel drive vehicle. You would go down to your you know, say your Chevy dealership, because this is the most common, the Chevy and GMC, and you'd order your brand new Chevy truck. And then you would order a NAPCO conversion kit. And that would be shipped in a big old heavy by 80-inch long crate.
Nice.
To the dealership. And it would only take a couple of mechanics about 3 to 4 hours to install this thing.
Not bad.
Exactly. They would take out the solid beam front axle. They'd only have to drill 4 holes in the frame.
Hmm.
And that truck in less than a day was four-wheel drive.
Very cool.
It was genius to the design. And what was the beauty of it too was they could then take that four-wheel drive setup. So let's say you use that truck for, you know, back then people didn't keep trucks for 20, 30 years very common. Mm-hmm. You know, you kept truck for 5, 10 years. It was pretty worn out.
Yeah.
So they'd use that truck 5, 10 years, and they could pull that kit out and they could put it in their next truck too.
Nice.
So, and that's actually something that they sold. Now, originally they sold it and they called it the Mountain Goat package. These are Mountain Goat trucks, but eventually pretty quickly it became known as the Power Pack. Nice. Package, the NAPCO Power Pack package. And this really put NAPCO on the map. And this is the NAPCO that people know today, from back then at least. Unfortunately, NAPCO history in the time of when they were actually making the Power Pack conversions is still very foggy because they made these conversions from approximately 1949 through 1959 for the passenger vehicles, and then up into the early 70s for larger 1 to 2 ton trucks.
Oh, wow. That was a long range.
It is. But eventually, NAPCO was absorbed into the Dana Corporation.
Mm.
And pretty much from most historians' research, it looks like the Dana Corporation destroyed, lost, whatever, all of the files for
That's a NAPCO. Shame.
It is. It really is. And, you know, heck, if those files are out there somewhere in someone's basement and you've got all the NAPCO stuff, we would take them at the museum and you know.
Proudly display.
Proudly display that stuff and make it public knowledge again.
Yeah.
But, so we really don't know the first NAPCO four-wheel drive rolled down the line. But we do know that eventually they were absorbed into Dana. And what killed them off as being a big manufacturer for many years was in 1960, General Motors took and redesigned their frame, so the NAPCO kit didn't work anymore. But even prior to that, in 1957, General Motors said, well, why are we spending all this money installing these at the dealerships? We can just install it on the factory floor.
Mm.
So in mid-1957, they went from being a dealer-installed item to being a factory-installed item, and it cost $800 less than having it done at the dealership.
Oh, wow.
So, and that was a lot of money back then. That was almost a third the cost of the vehicle.
Oh, I believe it.
So, so that's kind of the NAPCO story in a nutshell.
Hmm.
And back to our history with the NAPCO, we found this fire truck out in Damascus, Maryland. Well, out in Maryland, and it originally served in Damascus, Maryland, and it's an open cab fire truck, which means it has no roof or doors. Never came with one.
It's kind of funny looking, but it's very cool and unique.
It is, isn't it? Yeah,
oh, yeah.
Absolutely. And we know that truck served until about 1970 and was eventually retired. And it was sold to somebody who used it as a sand hauler. And then after that, it was basically retired. And it was given back to the fire department, changed hands a couple of times. And then we obtained it, of course.
And that was, if I remember correctly, that was one of two of a design like that?
So there are two known open cab task force fire trucks, but there's only one four-wheel drive one. We have the only four-wheel drive open cab, and that's a 56 Chevrolet NAPCO. So that would have been one of the conversion kit ones. It would have been, and it's a ton and a half, our version. It's got 10 lug wheels and all that. It would have been brought to a dealership somewhere and had that done. When it was brand new. So we were able to rescue that truck. Still has the original tires on it. It does not have the original engine. At some point that was replaced. We don't know why, because the truck only has about 18,000 miles on it.
Hmm.
But one of our goals is to get the NAPCO truck restored and operational so we can take it to museums, or not museums, take it to parades and take kids and whatnot.
If we do that, we got to get the hose working.
So you can spray the kids?
Maybe.
You're such a delinquent. You're such a delinquent. That would be a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I know that I was a little long-winded there on the NAPCO story, but it's just some of the research. I do want to give credit to a couple of sources. Now, I've been researching NAPCOs and NAPCO history for a number of years now, but by all means, I am not a, the main historian on these.
Not a certified expert?
Yeah, not a certified, there you go.
Just
not,
certifiable?
Yeah, certifiable, exactly, exactly. A lot of this came from a website called NAPCO4x4.org. I don't know who the owners of the website are, but they've got a lot of great information, a lot of history on there. And so if you're interested in reading about the history of NAPCO and the families involved behind it, I would recommend checking out NAPCO4x4.org. In fact, maybe we can get up a link to our on our website to that for people to check out as well. We'll put a link right in the description of this podcast. And other information from other online sources and other books that we've read over the years and whatnot. So kind of pieced it together. But, one of the beauties of NAPCO and the history of NAPCO is there's still mystery to this day surrounding it. Like I said, a lot of the history is not known. It's been lost to history. And so we're always learning. So if somebody has more information that they would like to share with us about the history of NAPCO, reach out to us.
Absolutely. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe there's an interview that was being worked on as part of that.
Well, we interviewed the gentleman. His name's Mike. He was the one that had purchased our truck from the fire department. And we interviewed him the day we picked it up. He has a beautiful collection of Chevy Task Force trucks, which is the 55 to 59 style Chevy and GMC trucks. And that was called the Task Force Series trucks. He had purchased it, and he actually, what was really nice, he was probably the best person to have that because he kept it in indoor storage for probably 15 years or something like that.
Oh, that's lucky.
Yeah, he kept it there, and he knew a lot about the truck, and he kept all the pieces, and he also acquired a lot of the original fire equipment that had been removed from the truck.
Oh, wow.
And we got a lot of that back from him when we purchased the truck and brought it in. But on top of that, he had another sale lined up for the truck prior to us getting a hold of him. But when he found out what we were going to do with the truck for the museum, he made the decision to sell it to us instead, and I believe for less money. He basically asked us to just reimburse him for what he had into it, which wasn't very much at all. And so we drove out to Maryland and had a whole adventure. I mean, you could almost probably do a podcast on some of those adventures that we've done. Went through a few trailer tires and things like that on the way
home. Get Andrew in on that one. I know he went on the trip.
Yeah, Andrew went on that trip, and his nephew Justin and our little brother Justin, and that was a blast. We had a lot of fun doing that. But so there's a lot of great history out there on the NAPCO trucks, and the NAPCO really is what started the factory putting four-wheel drive, at least General Motors at least. Now some people will say that General Motors stole the NAPCO design, which, the more I've researched that, and I used to be one of those believers myself, okay, but the more I've researched it, it looks like NAPCO was already using a lot of the GM parts to build their kit to then turn around and sell back to GM. So it's a chicken or egg situation.
Yeah.
We're always interested in learning more about that, and John, what else? You got any other questions?
Well, I was wondering something. You mentioned that the NAPCO conversions were sold in a kit. Was that something the consumer could ever buy, the end user, or was that only a dealer or factory available item?
There's one of the things that's kind of lost to history. I have seen it written both ways. It appears that most of them were done at the dealer. But I have read different places that you could purchase one and do it yourself or whatever.
Cool. So got to know a guy who knows a guy.
I kind of think that was one of the cases because I've never in all the research run across, say, an advertisement for NAPCO that said, buy this and have it shipped to your house.
Ah.
Yeah. It was always order it from your dealer this way.
Makes sense.
I've read about some tractor dealerships installing them on trucks that people already owned.
Hmm.
So maybe it was one of those type of things where you just had to be a business. I don't really know.
Yeah.
And that would be interesting to know. And I know that time, you know, figure in the mid-50s, you know, somebody who is kicking around in the mid-50s is now in their 80s.
Yeah.
So if somebody out there knows for sure the answer to that question, please reach out to us.
So what about sort of parts and serviceability, you know, nowadays for some of those? A lot of those, obviously, parts, seals, bearings go bad over time. You mentioned a lot of them use stock GM parts. Are there any specific parts, the NAPCO, that are still made or can be ordered, or are you pretty much left to forums and, you know, Craigslist type stuff?
Well, that's a great question, John. So the standard one-ton conversion kit, which we really didn't even touch on, the half-ton GM truck of the time would not accept the NAPCO kit because the driveline was a sealed driveline called a torque tube setup.
Oh.
And so the conversion kits were all done in 3/4 and 1-ton trucks for the most part. Those trucks are using factory GM parts that are still readily available today for the most part. There might be a few pieces here and there that are getting more difficult. Where it gets a little more difficult is in the rarer versions of the NAPCO kits, which are in the 1.5-ton and 2-ton versions.
Yeah.
And that's what we have at the museum. We have the 1.5-ton version, which one of the things that we've been able to not figure out essentially about NAPCOs is how many were made. There seems to be, nobody has an exact number, but most historians believe that at the very low end, there was somewhere around 1,500 NAPCO four-wheel drive conversion kits made, and at the high end, maybe 8,000 or 9,000.
That's still pretty low numbers, relatively speaking.
It really is. But at the same point, the 1.5-ton conversion is the rarest of them, the 10-lug one, and they believe that potentially less than a couple hundred of those were ever made.
Oh, wow.
So our open cab truck at the museum is really a trifecta of rarity. It's one of only two open cab task force fire trucks. It's a four-wheel drive, and then it is the 1.5-ton version.
Nice.
So why don't we take a little break, John, and we'll get back to it after that.
Sounds good. I think I need to go refill my water cup here.
All right, there you go.
Is your septic system ready for the spring rains and melting snow? Let the experts at ABC Home and Commercial Services inspect your tank and properly pump it. A little preventative maintenance goes a long way in avoiding a system failure. Call ABC Home and Commercial Services today at 810-794-5678, and they'll be on their way. A septic pump is as easy as ABC. ABC Home and Commercial Services, 810-794-5678. That's 810-794-5678.
All right, we're back from the break here from talking about the history of the NAPCO 4x4. And once again, you know, like I said, I apologize if there's any sort of misinformation here. But there's a lot of fog around NAPCO history, so we're trying to fill in what we can, and we'll probably do more podcasts in the future as we learn more. I know, John, you said you had a few questions about the truck and about, you know, how we obtained it and things like that. So why don't you shoot?
Well, the biggest thing is I've helped move a few vehicles in that place, and I've seen, you know, the doors and spaces, and that thing's huge. How in the world did you get that in the building?
Well, so to paint a picture for our listeners here, our long Quonset hut building, of course, would make sense if it had a door in one end or the other, but it does not. Our main entry door is a big about 10 by 10 roll-up door that goes into the side of the Quonset hut. So anything we bring in, we have to bring in and we have to immediately get it turned one way or the other. Well, the NAPCO is, I think it's about 22 feet long. So she's longer than your regular, you know, Chevy Suburban or SUV. She's a small fire truck, but she still has some decent size.
Oh, yeah. And pretty wide and tall, too.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, it's very wide, very tall. And so we had to bring it backwards into the building. And then we had to pick it up. As you know, or at least I think you know, it doesn't run very well. At least it doesn't move under its own power anymore. That's one of the restoration things for the future. But we brought it in, and then we had to lift up the back end with a forklift and get it jockeyed over. In the future, we're hoping to get a set of go-jacks. A lot of museums use those, where you can jack up the vehicles hydraulically under all the tires.
Use those at the service center I used to work at. Very handy.
They are. We need the biggest set. Most of our vehicles are very heavy. They now just released, maybe less than a year ago, a set that can lift. I think it's their SUV set. We're talking about $1,700 for a set of four of those. Well, that's something else. Raising money. We're looking for some grant funding through the museum, and hopefully we can get, or somebody wants to donate us a set, by all means, we could use them. But we used a forklift delicately and got her moved into place.
Very cool. Now, you mentioned it's not running under its own power?
No. So a couple of things that we found out when we picked up the truck. Of course, it wasn't running at all when we picked it up. Originally, it had a 265 V8 engine in it. But at some point in the past, and I think it was probably burned up because the truck is so, those NAPCO kits were so low geared. We believe that the axles are geared to 617, which is a very deep ratio on this truck. And we could be mistaken on that, but we believe that's what it is. There's even an old warning from when it was part of the fire department that says, do not take this truck over 50 miles an hour.
Cool.
On the dashboard. And so we're thinking that there's a good possibility that it was run way past red line and blown up.
Yeah.
And it currently has a 61 283 V8 in it. And when we got it, it wasn't running. We did get that V8 running, but it has no compression on most of the cylinders.
And oh, bummer.
So it barely runs. And the transmission, because it was an open cab truck, it was had water running down into it for many, many years, and all the gears are rusted solid. So the transmission is going to need a full rebuild. And then eventually we would like to acquire the proper 265 V8 for the truck. There's no real reason to rebuild the wrong engine for it.
Yeah. So that answered my question about if it shifted still.
Yeah, so. No, it doesn't shift. In fact, we had to take our volunteer, Justin, the kid that works at the museum with us sometimes, and when we brought it in and out, we needed somebody to hold the clutch down because it wouldn't move if you didn't do that.
Yeah.
And that clutch is a heavy clutch, and he had all his weight on that thing for a couple of, probably 20, 30 minutes while we were maneuvering things.
Wow.
And yeah, he was a little sore after that.
I believe it. I'm wondering something too. You mentioned that's the original tires on that still?
As far as we can tell.
Wow.
One of the really cool parts about the truck is that the guy that we got it from had done a bunch of history on it, and he has all these black and white photos and whatnot going all the way back to when the truck was new. And being the truck only has 18,000 miles on it, documented miles, and it still has the Goodyear tires that were in the pictures back in 1956 with the little white triangles on them that they had chalked in for parade use, and you can still see the chalk in the white triangles on or the paint. Maybe it's a paint. I think it's a chalk in the tires. So the tires are pretty cupped and bald now, but they all hold air.
So that's impressive.
70 years later, almost, and they're holding air. You know,
that's very impressive.
Absolutely.
So what are some of the future plans? I know you talked about restoring it, eventually getting it back to its former glory as a fire truck?
Yeah, absolutely. This truck, to be done properly, and really this is going to be another episode on a podcast one day. We might even talk about the benefits of restoration versus preservation on museum displays. But for right now, this is one that probably should be restored to be put back in her former working glory. All the equipment's there. Something we didn't really touch about in the history of this truck is originally it wasn't even a 56 Chevy. Originally, the fire truck from Damascus, Maryland was a 32 Rio, and they blew the engine in the Rio and bought the 56 Chevy chassis and front end and converted it over with all their equipment. So the back end of the truck, the pumps and everything are all from 1932.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So a lot more historic value to that than I thought.
Yeah, so we want to get that all operational. They even have, I don't remember what they call them for sure, they have fire truck shows that you can go to where they actually pumper shows where they spray the nozzles and everything.
Oh,
and
very cool.
So it'd be nice to get it operational again someday so it could be shown like that.
I'll volunteer to help test the nozzle.
Oh, there you go. Cool. What else you got for me, John?
Not much I can think of off the top of my head. Answered a lot of the questions I have on that. I know there's an album book on the display piece in the museum that's got a lot of those pictures there. And I know we have some of the original display pieces behind it and in it, as far as the original equipment for it and everything.
Yes, we do. And as we've mentioned in previous podcasts, the museum's open 10 to 3 every Sunday. Mm. And so if you're going to... And by appointment as well. So if you'd like to come down to the museum in Clay Township, Michigan, and check out the NAPCO, we can show you a lot of the old documentations and pictures and whatnot of the NAPCO when she was in operation. And eventually we'll get some of that uploaded to the website as well. You can get some information on our website about it and our adventures of going out and getting it. There's already some write-ups on there.
I know we have a lot on Facebook of that too.
We do.
A lot of event pictures and trip pictures and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a pretty cool. It's been a pretty cool adventure. We're really glad that we were able to save this one, and hopefully, it's one of many more to come. Obviously, we have a lot more displays in the museum, but it was our first. So, for the majority of our board, it holds a special place. We really want to see it, running and driving and back to its former glory someday. Maybe a corporate sponsor will pick it up or something They want to do that.
Yeah,
but. Well, you think we should probably wrap this one up, John?
I think it's about that time.
I think it is, too. So, John, why don't you remind our folks where to find out about us more, about the museum, and where the podcast and all that?
Yeah, we can always get more information about us at the Museum of Off-Road Adventure on Facebook or themora.org. As far as the podcast, we have information on Facebook under Wheelin'. Remember, there's no G on the end. And then wheelinradio.com. We'll link you right to our page with links to other episodes and other information that we talk about on the show.
Awesome. Well, I'm Keith. And
I'm Johnny Orange.
Signing off.
Have a good one, people.